think of compassion is a very nice one. I spent PhD at Washington University in St. Louis on the topic of compassion. So this is a different, you know, misplaced compassion. So many things to say. Not really sure where to begin. I'll begin because this is on the screen. This is a nice picture, a painting, an illustration of the material and the spiritual realm as it's described within the Vedic literature. And this is one universe pictured here of so many universes. Vedas describe many, many universes, as many as there are waves in the ocean. That's a lot of waves. It's a lot of universes. Some of you can't count. They're limited. And very similar to other cosmologies, there's lower planets, hellish planets. There's upper planets. Heaven just happens to be in the range of seven upper, seven lower. Heaven is number three, according to the Vedic cosmology. And then above and above and above, the topmost position in the universe. And then the lowest position in the universe. But all of those places within the universe are outside of the spiritual realm. And in between the spiritual realm and the material realm, there's this Brahma-jyoti. Jyoti means light. Like looking at that thing, the projecting light, very, very bright. And within the vastness of the bright spiritual sky, there are spiritual planets, each of them eternal. They don't come into being and go out of being. There's no Big Bang. It's just they're there eternally. And within the vastness of the spiritual sky, there's a cloud. And I'm supposed to speak about 9/11 from a spiritual perspective. That's why I'm doing this. In this region, the clouded region, there are these universes that form from the ingredients of the cloud, like the elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, mind, intelligence, false ego. Those elements make up the cloud, and they, like, it's like a womb, and they're the energy. Those energies are ingredients, like the mother supplies the ingredients for the formation of a child. And the universe, the cloud, supplies ingredients for the formation of whatever goes on within the universe. It's hard to say it quickly. It's a very deep subject. But the expanding, unfolding, and the maintenance and the collapsing, the subtle elements or the grosser elements into the grosser elements into the subtler elements and dissolving into an unmanifest state and resting, and then the Vedic picture of time is things are cyclical. Just within the past several days, my memory is not as sharp as it was. Someone was describing the picture of creation that theoretical physicists have these days is down to micro-milliseconds. They can say what happened before the Big Bang, and then the expanding of the Big Bang, and then their picture is it implodes back upon itself into a resting state, which is what modern science is now saying, and it's very similar to what the Vedic science is saying. But in this region, where we are, there is a certain design. Comes into being, stays for some time, birth, old age, disease, and death, right from Bhagavad Gita. Janma Mrityu Jara Vyadi in Sanskrit. Things come into being, they stay for some time, they get old, some byproducts are produced, and they are dissolved. And we're very attached to trying to be enjoyers of this place. And as long as we maintain that disposition of trying to enjoy this place, we stay here. If that binds us, the desire to be a fruitive enjoyer binds us to the cycle of birth and death. I'm trying to give a real quick picture of this place here. And there are laws of nature for the intended plan of harmony. And when one abides by those laws that are for harmony, that's a life of goodness. And from the position of goodness, one can begin to perceive that which is without beginning and end, that the spiritual dimension of life, like, you know, within your heart and within each person and within the whole grand picture of things. When we don't live in harmony with those natural laws, then nature reacts. There's the biblical saying is, as you sow, so you shall reap. I brought with me a printout of something that Billy Graham, those of you that are American, you know who Billy Graham is, and those of you from China, you don't know who Billy Graham is, right? Never heard Billy Graham? I'm looking at you too. No, behind you. Never heard. He's a famous, powerful TV evangelist, a Christian who got millions of people to get on board with the message of Christianity. And his daughter, Anne Graham, was interviewed just 2 days after 9/11 on TV, on a talk show. And we all, those of us living in the States especially, remember how intense the feelings were of people. Because my base is New York. I was not in New York when this thing happened. But I was told that those that were in New York at that time, everyone became very religious. Like, you know, New York is go, 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 and aggressive. So what happened was, at every crosswalk, you know, normally people don't wait for the walk stop. They just go whenever they can go. They stopped, and they had little shrines or altars, you know, at each corner, praying. A Buddhist, you know, right next to the Muslim, right next to the Christian, right next to the whatever, at every single crosswalk. And they were praying, not just they can get at the other side of the street, but the bubble of we're safe because we're New Yorkers and nothing's going to come to New York and cause a problem. People became just the opposite. The bubble burst. So I went to New York about 1 month afterwards because we had one person sitting with one of these instruments, sitting alone with a little sign saying people that are stressed, we'll give some counseling. We have a place nearby. The people were stressed. He just sang very softly, and crowds of people would come. Crowds of people would come and just sit and hear the sound. So I came 1 month later, and we had, you know, we just sat on the ground, about 10, 15 people. And as soon as we sat down, because it was at Union Square, 14th Street, because you couldn't go below Houston Street because it was all cordoned off. Unless you lived there, no one was allowed. It was horrific, like Catholic. So it was a congregating place, Union Square, 14th Street. A crowd of about 150 people sat down. We sat down, they sat down, we didn't even start singing. And people in suits, and, you know, models, sat cross-legged with us, you know, sitting where the ladies were sitting, people crying. This is a month later. And the outpouring of the heart was, you know, cut with a knife. It was very, very palpable. Just this, I don't know if people know what the message was, what the meaning was, but the sound vibration, they got the gist of it. We're praying. We're calling to God for peace. And it was incredible. It reminded me very clearly of so many years ago, and we used to sit in Washington Square Park, and people would come around. The counterculture people would come and chant with us, because they were looking for another alternative besides, you know, the status quo or the phaseology, the timeless, the establishment. You get into some adjectives. Corporate establishment. Military complex. Anyway. Because we were searching for something, and you go to New York City today, you don't see shrines and every crosswalk, and people are running, you know, they're back to being New Yorkers again. Aggressive, you know, insensitive, go people. So when the message here is, when we violate the natural order of things, the natural order of things, by that I mean you know, like when you buy an electronic device. Here's a little electronic device. When you buy one, they give you a little operator's manual. Here's how do you use it. And if you don't know how to use it, somebody got me one of those Galaxy 3 phones. Whoa! Bells and whistles. I don't know how to use the thing. But with it comes an operator's manual. So similarly with one of these, here's an operator's manual. Here's how you use it. Here's how you utilize this valuable machine, the human form of life. And if you don't properly use it, if you don't heed the natural order of things, then you can harm the machine. You certainly don't get the best benefit of the machine. And with the nature of the place here, there's birth, death, disease, and old age. And sometimes it happens slowly, sometimes it happens rapidly, sometimes it happens wholesale. Like, I did some research. Well, it came out in some publications, so I did some further research. When 9/11 happened, they have records that go back to 1181, when huge numbers, you know, different parts of the world, not just one part of the world, where there's calamity, natural calamity, famine, earthquakes, all kinds of things, huge numbers of people at once. So that's nature rebelling. And then there's people that have a sense of the greater good. I'm going to go into maybe some delicate territory here. Some greater good, because compassion, I don't have time to get this on my computer, I'm just going to do it with my hand. There's three components to compassion. One is feeling or empathy. I feel for another's situation. There's a cognitive component. I understand or have some understanding of another's difficulty or suffering. And there's a motivational one. I do something about it because I feel it. And I understand it, I want to do something about it. Those are direct dictionary definitions, because this is, now I'm giving you a synopsis of what I did yesterday at Washington University. Compassion. I feel for another's difficulty or suffering. I understand to some degree another's difficulty or suffering. I want to do something about it. Each of them are components of compassion. And so in the presentation over on this side, maybe some of you have heard of a book called From Good to Great, Jim Collins. No. It's a corporate thing. He's one of these motivational speakers, and he spent 5 years with a staff of 21 people full-time studying Fortune 500 companies. Not just the good ones, but the great ones, and what makes them great. And it's seven values. Great, it comes from leadership. And the leadership that's great, this is, 5 years, you don't have to buy the book, now here's what it says. There's two features of great leaders. One is that they're humble. They might be from New York. They're humble. And then another is they are interested in the greater good. They're highly motivated as a leader to do something that's going to make a difference in the world. You know that commonly in the university, young people seeing today is social activism. You do something for the benefit of others, of the bigger others. And there's so many ways that can be expressed, but that's a strong sense of life's mission, something greater than just my little self, but something that's going to make it a better place for us to be in, and others, not just me. The me generation is now the us generation. How to make the place a better place and add value. So, very active in achieving the greater good of others. But supposing someone has a mistaken understanding, misplaced compassion, mistaken understanding of the greater good of others. I'm going to go back again to Bhagavad Gita. There's a whole chapter dedicated to answering the following question. At the beginning of one chapter, Arjuna asks Krishna, if people don't have faith in the natural order of things, if they don't have faith in your advice to them how to lead their lives in harmony with the laws of nature and in harmony with the divine, if they don't have faith in that, are they going to have some other kind of faith? Faith in something else? And the answer is yes. In short, faith is there intrinsic to the soul, that little spark that animates life, bodies and plants and birds and, existence. There's a spark of life within every one of us. And that quality of faith is intrinsic for the soul, or the self, the inner self. And if we don't have faith in the natural order of things, we're going to have faith in something else. And it's according to the modes of nature. So my idea, if it's in the mode of darkness or the mode of ignorance, the greater good may be what happened in 9/11. Faith that's misguided, or compassion that's misguided. That ends up in destruction, because that's the quality, according to Bhagavad Gita, of the influence of the mode of ignorance. It leads to destruction, or it is of destruction. Within the universe, there's creation, maintenance, and destruction. And the mode of ignorance is the destructive force. So my faith may be guided in thinking what's good for others that's destructive, misguided. I'll give a little personal example. It's not 9/11, but when I was a small boy, I lived in upstate New York, a little tiny place. You people from Massachusetts might even know. The Finger Lakes in New York State. Cornell University is at the bottom of one of those, Ithaca Lake, Vertical Cornell. So right next to that one is another one, and I was in a little town, and where I lived, there was a in a 9-year cycle, there was an infestation of locusts. Those are those little guys that have like 8 wings, and they when they travel around in swarms, like thousands, and you could, when they came in, the sky is dark, like it's night, and then they would land on the trees, and you could hear them chomping away at the leaves until the leaves were gone. And then they'd zoom to another place and devour all the foliage. So that was one of those years. I was like 4 years old. And my mother had an idea that to keep the locusts from the garage, she bought some black flag poison and one of those little plunger things and gave to her little 4-year-old son, me, to go in the garage and spray the garage to keep the locusts out. And then I saw a little kitty cat. And I thought, oh, I'll spray the kitty cat so that she won't get any locusts. Good intention. And in the morning, the cat was dead, lying in the middle of the garage floor. And I realized something. It was very painful. I mean, I cried a lot, but it was... I learned that good intention is not good enough. Or you can be guided to do something that you think is good for another, and it's not good for another. That's, if you don't have proper understanding and training and so forth. And then down here, everyone's running around with some idea of something that's good. But it could be detrimental. So put these two things together. Persons that are leading lives that are not consistent with the natural order of things. And other persons, so there's some reaction for that. Let me just read what Anne Graham said when she was asked a question. How could God let something like this happen? It was 2 days after 9/11. She answered, I believe God is deeply saddened by this, just as we are. But for years we've been telling God to get out of our schools, get out of our government, and get out of our lives. And being the gentleman he is, I believe he has calmly backed out. How can we expect God to give us his blessings and his protection, and if we demand he leaves us alone? And some bunch of other things. You know, somebody came along and said, what was her name? Madeline Murray O'Hare made a big issue about prayer in school. And she made a big scene about it, and prayer was prevented from school. We said, okay. And then so many other okays. Don't do this, and you know, secularism prevailed. And people not having the proper sense of what to do and what not to do. In part of my life, major part of my life, I spend extending to people, to individuals or groups of people, helping them not just change their behaviors, but develop deeper qualities like gratitude, respect, appreciation for others. Because when there's qualities, what's inside, it comes out. The behaviors are automatically taken care of. Just like teaching a child, it's all over the world. Somebody gives something to the child, and the parents say, what do you say? And then the child is supposed to say, thank you. It doesn't matter what language, what culture, it's universal. And then they want something. And then the parents say, what do you say? Please. It's like one of those little dolls that you tilt and it says something. So there's the tilt. It's a behavior.
please, thank you. It's a behavior. But where's the... Teaching a behavior is one thing, and teaching character is another thing. Gratitude, where it's really from inside, it's thank you. Where there's such a quality as gratitude, it's the seed of love. When you feel grateful to another for something that you've received from another, love is naturally going to follow in the course of time, at least initially, gratitude. And then that gratitude, it brings out good behavior, and it checks the other kind, even if there is this tendency for some other kind. You don't do, because you feel something for the other person. The spiritual perspective, because that's my assignment here, on 9/11, is where people have lost touch with that. And since they've lost touch with that, there's some kind of faith in something else. And that's what happened. Somebody cooked up a plan that said it'll be good for the people of the world if those World Trade Towers are knocked down, because it's a symbol of something. Western imperialism and all the ugliness that goes along with it. Knock those towers down. They tried it before with explosives. They got stopped. So they tried it another way. It's good. It's the greater good. Knock down those towers. So faith that's moved by a different mode of nature than one that's elevating. But faith. Strong faith. Faith enough that they did what they did. They gave up their lives and they destroyed a bunch of things with some conviction. So misguided compassion or misguided faith. And it's very unfortunate. I'll just end this section, quickly run to the other section, because the clock isn't stopping, it's still moving. What we did at the very beginning, this chanting, I'll call it sacred sound. Sacred sound has an effect that it cleanses the heart. I mean, you're not used to this, most of you, but what one of the persons in the audience here was with us, and this past weekend, weekend before, the Labor Day weekend, we were at a community, spiritual community, a yoga farm in mid-Pennsylvania. And we spent the whole weekend with this and chanting on beads with sacred sounds. And I can tell you, wow, it was wonderful. I've been doing this for a number of years. Pam over here has been doing this only a short period of time. So it affected both of us in a different way. But it brings you closer to this. And, you know, this takes its proper perspective of, okay, and let me live in harmony, and let me be situated at least on the conscious plane here with the divine, with the supreme, and, you know, seeing others in that way also as spirit soul sparks of this divine. And let me relate to persons in that way. It happens from that. The heart becomes cleansed. Side by side, I'm going to end with this, side by side, there needs to be some direction. Where do you take that condition of heart? It needs some teaching, spiritual teachings. Both are needed. An example that's given is two rails for trains, except for monorails, they only need one, but the other ones. Trains move on two rails, so if you have one without the other, you have a problem. The train doesn't go. It'll fall over. So, similarly, for spiritual development, spiritual progress, awakening compassion and its proper application, is something that cleanses the heart and something that guides our activities in life. The user's manual. How do you use this machine, the human form? One without the other is incomplete. If there's something that makes the heart a little cleansed, it can be sentiment and at times even fanaticism. Sentiment that's unbridled and not properly directed. Fanaticism. That's not good. We all know that's not good. So the other side needs to be there, and that's the proper direction of that condition of heart. But you just have the direction without the pure heart, and it's dry speculation. You need both. So that's the conclusion. The remedy is these two things. Something that makes the heart pure, something that directs our activities of life. Something that's standard, and that it's descending from this position, not speculated from a position of darkness. Maybe it's this and that. End of that section. Now I want to go to the other topic. It's related. The topic of compassion and compassion that's misplaced. And please just give me half a minute here. I'm going to go quickly, so fasten your seatbelt, speak quickly. This is a painting of a king named Bharat. Bharat is such an important king that in their Declaration of Independence, like we have the United States, in India it's Bharat Varsha. He's such a prominent king. And when he was still very young, he was the king of the emperor in a previous age of mankind. He was an emperor of the world. Powerful. Yeah, like something that everybody wants. Power. And he was not interested in it. He was interested in achieving his spiritual perfection. So he turned his kingdom over to his sons, went to the forest to detach himself from worldly life, and engaged himself in a process of meditation. Meditation on a form of Vishnu that's pictured here. And in the course of his meditating, one fine day, early in the morning, before the sun rose, was the practice. He would go to the river, take his morning bath, sit by the side of the river, and do his meditation. And on that particular day, there was a deer on the opposite side of the river. And the deer was fearful, looking here, looking there, drinking the water, looking up like deer will do. And he was noticing the deer, and all of a sudden there was a loud roar of a lion. And the deer panicked. And it was a female deer. She had a miscarriage, pregnant deer, and the fawn dropped on the other side. She leaped and jumped into the water. And the river was moving swiftly. She was carried downstream, drowned, and died in a cave by the side of the river. Just enough to get out of the river water, but she died. So here was the king, protector of the citizens, and saw this little baby deer. Naturally, he went to the other side of the river and picked up the deer and started caring for the deer. He became so absorbed. This is the compassion, natural, properly placed compassion. Improperly placed was he became so absorbed in the deer that his higher purpose became slackened and his attention went entirely to the deer. Even when he was doing his practices, spiritual practices, his attention was, is the deer safe? Is the deer okay? And so on and so on and so on and so on. His mind was not with his higher purpose. Eventually, he stopped his spiritual practices and just his life became absorbed in this little deer. And then as the deer grew up, one fine day, the deer went away. And there's a whole long section where he's lamenting, "Oh, I've offended this poor deer. Oh, dear." But the deer is very kind. Surely the deer will come back and be compassionate upon me and be kind upon me after all I've done to help the deer. And, "Oh, dear, where's the deer?" So all night long he couldn't sleep. So he went looking for the deer. And when he went looking for the deer, he came to the edge of a cliff, fell off the cliff, and crashed to the bottom on jagged rocks and died. And when he died, his thoughts were on the deer. And so, at the time of death, whatever it is that you think of at the time of death, that state you will attain. There's a statement of Bhagavad Gita that says like that, "Yam yam vapi smaran bhavam chajatante kalevaram." It's in Sanskrit. It says, whatever your mind is fixed on, at the time of death, the mind will carry you to that situation, that state you will attain. So what you fix your mind on here is going to carry you to the next situation. So in his next life, he became a deer. You said three lives. So that's the second one. So he lived that life as, fortunately, because of his previous life's elevated condition, he was gifted with special remembrance of his previous life as a king and a great devotee, a great saintly person. So he went to that place where there were sages living in the forest, and he just hung out with the sages. Would, you know, hear their discussions and take the remnants of their food and just be in their company till he died as a deer. And his third life, he came back as the son of a priest, a brahmana. And he decided he wasn't going to make the same mistake twice. So he lived his life as if he was a dullard. He, you know, couldn't understand, couldn't speak, deaf and dumb, kind of. But he was fully aware, fully spiritually aware. And that came out later when the king who was his successor, he had some talk with that king. I'm summarizing several chapters of the Bhagavatam quickly. So misplaced compassion. Misplaced compassion is not... this is the discussion from last night. Now I'm saying it again. I have someone that's very close to me and very dear to me that just had spine surgery. And it wasn't... There's, you know, degrees of severity. This was a severe one. So I care about them. So I'm thinking about, you know, their bodily thing. And I'm also thinking about their mind, because they're active person. It's really tough to just lie down in a bed all day, or, you know, just you do a little something and you're totally fatigued and you can't do anything anymore for the day. You have to lie down. So the body and the mind are objects of this compassion. Remember, you feel for the other person, you understand the other person, you want to do something. But if you lose the perspective on the deeper well-being of the self or the soul, then those other kinds of compassion are misplaced. Or say it the other way around. When thinking about... It doesn't mean you neglect... The mistake of the king was not that he cared about the deer. The mistake of the king was he lost track of his higher purpose. So, this is like a contemporary, like current time frame. This last couple of months, this devotee, individual. By thinking of their spiritual well-being, it lifts their spirits better than just, you know, expressing and emoting some concern for their condition, because I'm not a physician. What can I do? Encourage them to do their physical therapy, be patient, and you know, their mind and their body, but seeing to their spiritual well-being. When persons have spiritual well-being and a spiritual drive, the body heals better. It's known in Harvard Medical School. They have studies of this, like galore, not just there, all over the place. And the mental state also becomes better. There's lots of studies on that subject. Where there's spiritual well-being, the condition of the mind is much lighter and happier. And the physical condition is also, even if there's some malady, it heals better. So the best thing is not don't care about the body or the mind, but the best thing is the well-being of the inhabitant of the body and the mind. Or this other little example, a birdcage. If one spends the whole time polishing the birdcage and neglects the purpose of the birdcage, which is the bird inside the birdcage, you need to give some nourishment to the bird inside the birdcage. Otherwise, poor bird is going to croak. Same, that there's this spark of life, the whatever somebody wants to call, the soul, the real self, the who we really are, the real person, the inner being. That needs to be searched out and nurtured. That's the human mission. Forget that one, and it's that other picture. You're still down here with darkness and misplaced good intentions. There's this saying, even the path to hell is paved by good intentions. Maybe you've heard that one before. Even the path to hell is paved by good intentions. So, misplaced compassion. That's part of what this story is. Be compassionate, but place that compassion properly. The lesson of Bhagavad Gita is precisely that. I'm going to end because the clock says it's 2 minutes before 9. We'll allow some time for some discussion. And then your snacks at the end. That's the best part. In Bhagavad Gita, the individual, it's a dialogue between two persons. It's part of a big epic, and the big epic is the struggle of good and evil. Classic one. And good wins, although sometimes it looks like they're going to lose. Because the mode of goodness is stronger. Light is stronger than darkness. Turn on the light switch, even if it's dark, light prevails, because light is stronger than darkness. So there's that morality and ethics kind of presentation in this big epic. And right in the middle is about the soul. So the storyline is there are some princes who are to become king, they're the rightful heirs of the throne. Their cousin brothers try to bump them off. You know, the good and evil struggle. So there's a war. And just at the beginning of the war, the person on the rightful heirs of the throne side says, I don't want to do this. And he gives his reasons why I don't want to. And, you know, it's very high-sounding ethical reasons. And then he submits to his friend, Krishna, what should I do? I'm confused. I mean, I know what I want to do, but I'm not really sure. So please give your advice. Please instruct me. So then the message is the same message that I've been giving, just said it in a different way. And I'm going to paraphrase, but the speaker of the Bhagavad Gita says, before we discuss what your duty is, let's talk about who you are. Novel idea. And the who you are part is this animating, eternal soul that doesn't come into being, never comes into being, never goes out of being. It's who we are. And then there's the covering of who we are. So don't identify with the covering identify with who you are. And then consider what your duty is. So that's kind of what I'm saying here. With the proper compassion is be concerned certainly with the packaging, but the packaging is driven by the animating force within, the conscious self. Human mission is to come to the highest potential of illumination or highest stage of consciousness, self-realization, God-realization, spiritual realization. The capacity, the potential is there, and there's an operating manual that tells you how to do it. Or there's systems of yoga of how to make that connection with the Supreme. And that's the path out of the darkness, linking with the Supreme. Different systems for doing that. Some like it this way, some like it that way. There are different systems. But the systems lead to that linking with the Supreme. Properly placed compassion comes from the proper use of this human form of life. Proper direction. How do I live my life? What's my duty? So, you know, just final sentence is, you're all students preparing for, you know, your careers and your later life. While you're doing all of that, please make sure you, you know, attend to the bird in the cage. You know, the inner self, the purpose for which this human form of life is given. And if that's not properly utilized, there are consequences. There's other forms of life besides this one that are suited for not using what the purpose is. That's what transmigration of the soul says. Whatever our consciousness is at the time we leave this body, that's the state we're going to attain. Okay. I jammed a whole bunch of stuff in a short time, but I hope it's okay. Any comments or questions? Yes.
Do you think that things done in the mode of ignorance are often unintentional or accidental?
Accidental?
Yeah. More so than intentional.
Or what do you mean by accidental?
Like something that would be considered done in the mode of darkness or ignorance. Is someone intentionally being ignorant?
No.
Most of the time?
No. It's possible. It's possible. It's certainly possible. But commonly, persons that are doing such things think, you know, it's selfish. You know, I'm going to get something. And if others get destroyed in the course of my getting something, hey. That's not, there are some people, I just want to hurt other people. But, you know, that itself is also darkness. Motivation is more, I want to enjoy at any cost. And if there's some loss for some other people, if that's the extent, that's okay. Because my enjoyment is no more thing. And not so much a meditation on, I want to bring pain to others. I want to destroy others. Like 9/11, they wanted to destroy. But there was this, at least my understanding of it was, that there was this is going to be good for a whole lot of people. If this is destroyed and these people are destroyed and the message is sent, stop being imperialist and bring your dirty culture over here to our part of the world. We don't like it. And we're going to tell you we don't like it. Here we go. Boom. At others' expense. Or a sense of being good. Just misguided. Yes?
Can you explain a little how it's not that difficult to relate to this nature of ours? Like it's pretty natural for us.
Hey, it's 1, 2, 3. The material nature is very powerful. And like the current of a stream, put a leaf or a piece of wood or a cork or something on a fast moving stream. So take us and put us in the middle of this current of material energy. It's so easy. There we go. And to think otherwise, take a lot of strength, a lot of presence. Even if you're a good swimmer, try to swim upstream. They still be going downstream. So, yeah, it's the design of, what's the other word? The design of this creation is such that it starts with the consciousness being covered by subtle layers of matter, so that the light doesn't get in, like filters. Do we have a subtle body besides the gross body? The first element that appears is the creation of false ego. And then material intelligence comes next. And then original mind. That subtle body covers the soul. So we think, act, and feel better. That subtle body comes to the gross body. It's really easy.
Looking that around to go.
Well, yes, flipping it around requires, as I was saying, something that cleanses that subtle body. I can make long descriptions of this, but a short, because of the time, the short is to get to the soul, to get to the spark of life, the consciousness being within, the conceptions of life that we're carrying have to be examined. And look at some alternative. It's a willful, conscious, willful act, not a blind, dumb, blind following thing. Cleansing, opening, cleansing, examining something else. And opting for whatever you feel is the better choice. It takes courage. It also takes proper guidance and association. One just last little thing on this is the mantra that we were chanting. The word mantra, two syllables, man refers to the mind, and tra is a Sanskrit word that means release, try to take, release the mind. So I'm holding on to this little device, supposing I want a cup of water. Maybe I could grab both at the same time, but the device now becomes easy to take a cup of water. So, in the conditioned state, the mind is holding on to the material conceptions, and everything that we see is through those filters. So you can hear, you see life, or see this truth, or spiritual reality, or something. It's filtered. The mantra helps release the mind from those material conceptions, so you can contemplate another conception. And then make choices. That's practically the last thing that's spoken by Krishna at the end of Bhagavad Gita is not explain, you decide. No arm twisting, no threatening, you can suffer if you don't do what I say. Because it's a head thing that the end is we have free will. Not you can't choose anything, we can choose between light and dark or material spiritual perception. Anyone else?
Okay.
talked about so many things that, well, I mean, I appreciate the ambition, and absolutely, but I can't help but just be preoccupied with this one today.
Yeah.
The living memory of it all. And,
not
at all. It's actually something that I needed to hear in terms of focusing on truly what the core things are. And it's not on the surface things, which I'm trying to keep that in mind.
The surface stuff falls in natural order when the internal thing is in order. And you keep, you can keep trying to adjust the shadow, but it's a secret. You go to the object that's casting a shadow, you take care of the shadow. But don't just deal with the shadow things. Deal with the object. The real self. Take care of the real part. You don't neglect it when you take care of the real thing first. That's the right one. So go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, it's not. It's an interesting thing to touch on, because ever since that day, I've been trying to make sense of the emotions and the experience of it. And, you know, I was like 14 when it happened, freshman in high school, my second week in high school. And it just completely threw off, like, my understanding of right and wrong. And what I remember most about it is a fear of what was going to come next. And, you know, I definitely...
You weren't even in the car.
I was, yeah.
I was
not in the city. I was in Long Island. So I had a couple friends in school that were directly affected and like that. So I was a little bit closer than most people, but everybody's watching it on TV. Everybody has their own story of that day. But what I remember being afraid of wasn't the New Yorkers all of a sudden slowing down and appreciating, you know, a moment on a corner to actually sit and reflect and be contemplative. It was the, you know, the effects after that, the wars, and the panic, and like the nationalism. And it scared me at that age.
I'd say.
Yeah.
So that, in one sense, is horrible. In another sense, it's a great opportunity. Like, what's the position of safety? What is that? If you have you're in a car accident, some awful something, some trauma comes, where does the mind go? What's that place of shelter? And the fact of the matter is, in the shadow, there's no shelter. You just turn the object a little bit, the shadow is gone, like a kaleidoscope. It's all the things that you invested so much in, just like that. So where's the place of safety? That's the reality. You can go on, like the Yorkers are going on now, and the Islanders are probably going out, and they'll be, well, you know, it's a long life. So. There's still no safety. So it's a good opportunity to consider what is the place of safety? And is there such a thing? Thoughtful persons don't need the calamity to enter into some thoughtful position of, is there something that's has all the meaning? You know, so you go there, maybe you get, you become an existentialist and say, there's nothing. There's nothing. Like Albert Camus, he got so absorbed in his teaching that this idea that life has no meaning. One day he was driving his car and just drove off the cliff because there's no meaning. So life is the same as death, and death is the same as life. There's no meaning. There's no white sand in the road, so I go off the cliff. Is there a place, is there a position such that not an imagined one of safety, but so where is it, if you get to the place where the eternal soul, you're in touch with it. And then spiritual reality.
reality. Faith, or spiritual practice, says, I don't know what it is, but I just have this feeling, this sense. There's something beautiful. You take away all the stuff, and there's something that's there. There's something you can be. I don't know exactly what it is, but there's something. And from that, it says what it's called the Tao Shuta, preliminary thing. Then there's a stage. The next stage is the association of some persons who are more accomplished in that realm. Spiritual reality, because like come to university and study whatever it is you want to study, because there are people that are professors in that field. Come to study biochemistry, and you're a professor of biochemistry. So there are such people. Sadhu, in a sense, the saintly person, like part of the deer, that's what the saintly person, holy man, staying in the forest. And next is in the association of those sadhus, you do what sadhus do. You do something, some devotional spiritual practice. And then with those spiritual practices, something happens. The heart becomes cleansed. The unwanted things in the heart become cleansed. And that becomes sentience. You just keep going. There's a science to the progression of consciousness to restore our original consciousness. Even in the material atmosphere, even when the stream is moving really fast, only natural in the sight. So, you have something. A soft voice. Sometime you're feeling some pressure. Always. And what's the pressure feel like? Feeling like unsafe. Okay, so your question is that feeling of some that pressure that I'm unsafe. Your question is that because you haven't connected to the light, like what you said? Yes. And then I'll just take it a step further. Light has a source, or energy has energetic. So connect with the energetic. Maybe you're connected to the light. When you're connected to the light, the darkness is gone. I remember a little story. I have an older brother. So when I was born, he told me this. I remember from the day I was brought back to the hospital, I shared the same room with him. We stayed in the same room. But one day, the furniture was changed, the beds were changed, and the light was out. And I was like, no, no. 5 years old, something like that. And woke up, had to use the bathroom, I just slammed my knee into the bed. The furniture had changed. But I found myself to see where's the door, where's the light switch, where's the furniture. It's about half an hour, I was like, feeling my way along. It was just resilient. So I remember that feeling. I didn't feel safe. You know, my parents' bedroom was right next to our bedroom, so I could have called out, help! But I didn't want to wake them up, disturb them. If I lived with that unsafe feeling, so I could turn on the switch then. Gone. Here was that feeling, gone. No endurance. like that. Like another metaphor, it's like a spark that falls some distance from the fire from which the spark came. And the spark will glow a little bit and become dimmer and dimmer. Just take that little carbon and bring it back to fire, full glowing capacity, just like touching it into the fire. Similarly, bring your consciousness in contact with the stream. That's called yoga. Yoga is linking with the Supreme. That's what it means. Linking with the Supreme. You bring your consciousness in contact with the Supreme. And that feeling, fear, uncertainty, that's being the same. When the light there, then the darkness is gone.
Happened to someone good.
the same. You didn't have a light. So, but there's a piece of you back there somewhere in the picture of the eternal soul. So, this soul existed before this body existed. Now I'm over here in this body, and I'm doing stuff. And some of the stuff I'm doing is good, and some of the stuff I'm doing is bad, and some of the stuff is kind of mixed. Those things, and this is a quick lesson, those things make impressions in the mind, sensory impressions, and they're evaluated by the law of nature or karma. So the body gets old and dies. The subtle body continues. Those impressions are there. They're stored like seeds. And then the subtle body carries the soul into the womb of the next mother and become born. I'm carrying those impressions from the previous life to this life. Tick tock, tick tock, tick tock. At some point, those seeds of desire and impressions appear. They awaken like a little seed fructifies. And, you know, the conditions have to be right, but they come out. And it has something to do with back there. It wasn't an accident that it came out.
I don't think, from my memory, it didn't say that God made the accidents happen. I think it was because of, like, what you were saying before, that the misguided compassion, and as a consequence of that, other people are affected by people's misguided.
But besides, why is the question?
Yeah.
Why I'm an innocent person. Somebody's misguided compassion came along and blindsided me. Why did it happen to me and not to her or to him? It happened to me. It has something to do with. It's not an accident.
Yeah.
That's my answer to it. Somebody's misguided. So I'm. Someone else is the fruit, is the instrument of my karma. And, you know, misguided, okay. But something back there, or back here, it's determining why. It's really difficult just to reduce it to something like that. To say, do you mean to tell me all those people that were in that World Trade Tower that had some dark stuff somewhere and they just got clobbered because of somebody's, you know, misguided compassion? Are you reducing it to that? And the answer is, it's very complex. But there's a principle. And that's in the complexity of things. Because there's so many things that not just I did one or two things. You're like, you know, little kids, right? My cat with black flag. It was really dumb. That was a kid. I didn't know better. So there's an impression. And, you know, that's not going on. I'm held responsible for my actions. Each of us. And the whole network is very complex. Very, very complex. But there's principles. You take away the principles. Yes, that's one principle, and there's another principle. I could tell some stories of people that should have been in that building, but they weren't in that building at that particular time. Or somebody that, you know, office was up here, they were down here delivering a message, or having a little conference, and then that happened, and they got up. So, why all the people that were normally in the upper floors weren't in the upper floors? Or, I mean, I know somebody was walking down the street, he was crossing the Hudson River on a ferry and saw the first one hit. It was too surreal. He didn't even believe it. He just kept going. And then he got off the ferry And as he was walking along, the second one hit. And he said, I mean, it's even hard to say this, but a big piece of stone went flying and the guy that was walking next to him just knocked his head off his body. And then hit him. And then he said, this isn't just, you know, surreal. I'm headed for cover. It was so surreal. You know, so why the guy next to him? Not him. Well, either way, you know, why not him? Or why the guy next to him? So there's why are some persons the recipient and some persons not? And how do you make sense of all this? So there's more than one piece to the puzzle. Yes?
I'd like to ask about the Mahabharata.
Okay.
I'd like to ask if you think that Vedavyasa
Yes.
The characters of the real life events, where they,
yes.
Do they actually take
it? Yes.
Are they more metaphorical?
No. That's my conviction. It has the history of a particular category. It's not. Some persons read it the way they go the second way. I don't read it that way. There are events that took place, and within the events, there's lessons. But not, the story was made up to teach lessons. I mean, say in reverse. Why would Vedavyas waste his time doing storytelling? Just making up things. He who that picture of the cosmic manifestation, the spiritual to the material world, with all kinds of details like size of planets, orbits of planets, and cosmology, down to really fine numerical definition of things, is going to just make up stories and say it's real, but he just made it up. He doesn't say it's made up. It's narrating or writing history. What are these? History made with you.
Because some say it has a very much, it's quite metaphorical in nature. There's a yogi, a little project that breaks down the characters in the Pandavas. They all represent, for example, the five different chakras in the body.
Or some say the five senses. And some say this, and some say that. So those who like to take indirect meanings do that. And your question to me was, do you take indirect or direct? And my answer is direct. Is that something? We're done? Fantastic. Thank you.